This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. So why is Bill Clinton seen as a respected elder statesman while Anthony Weiner has become persona non grata after both were embroiled in sexual controversy and scandal? Our guest Eric Dezenhall has been putting out reputational fires for many years as the CEO and founder of the crisis management firm Dezenhall Resources in Washington, D.C. He's also written a new book. It's called Glass Jaw, about how we live in a world of instant scandal, largely because of social media and the many outlets for stories about people behaving badly. Dezenhall provides advice from the real world about how to manage and mismanage a crisis and joins us today on Radio Times. Nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Marty.
Glass jaw is a boxing term. It's the title of your book. What does it mean?
It means you can't take a punch. And the general, I learned the term as a kid growing up in South Jersey. I went with a neighbor, the son of Joey Giardello, who was a middleweight boxing champion and a neighbor of mine. And we went to the local gym and I saw this big fighter get in the ring with kind of a nobody-looking fighter. I mean, the guy looked like he could be a local stock boy at a hardware store. And I couldn't believe that this match I was about to watch, and within about a minute, this nobody-looking guy takes down this giant. And my friend looked at me and said, glass jaw. And I'd never heard the term before. And it basically means this guy who looked really rough could not take a hit. And the analogy is today, David and Goliath have switched positions. Big shots are very easy to take down by little shots.
Little shots with a Twitter account.
With a Twitter account. And the ability of the giant to fight back is really limited. And I think a lot of people believe wrongly that if you're a big company or you're a big celebrity, you have all these resources. And what I argue is you're actually uniquely weak.
Do these big giants, or these big companies, do they know that yet?
They're beginning to know it because they are finding that all of the cliches they hear about damage control, like moronic things like get ahead of the story, which means nothing. It sounds good. But, you know, here you have Toyota, the Susan Komen Foundation, GM, the NFL, Paula Deen. You have these very well-known organizations and institutions who, no matter what they do, they can't dig out of it.
Well, and I could take all of those and we could probably do an hour
on
each. But and even beyond getting ahead of the story, does it ever make sense just to be honest?
Well, sure.
To admit fault?
Sure it does. But you're not forgiven to the degree you might think you are. I mean, first of all, the phrase get ahead of the story comes from a day. I mean, my career began more than 30 years ago in an environment where in the Reagan White House, where I started out as I was a kid, we had to worry about three evening newscasts and three newspapers. And if you were able to get to someone before deadline with your position, that was getting ahead of the story. Now, what's interesting is the calls I get from prospective clients, they all throw out this phrase, get ahead of the story. And I have to tell them, you can't get ahead of something when you're under it.
Mm.
And what happens now is things move so fast, there is no getting ahead of it.
Does that mean laying low? I mean, broadly speaking, low until it passes over?
Sometimes. Done? I mean, the old rule of thumb, I mean, if you were looking at what I was writing 25 years ago, I was saying hit back hard, hit back fast. I don't say that anymore because now you have such news congestion that if you end up diving in front of this train, you may make something about you that may pass out of the news when Kim Kardashian just does something stupid next or there's an Ebola crisis. I mean, you look at the CEO of Microsoft made some remarks about women in the workplace, and within days, even though he had to apologize, the Ebola situation completely ate the news. And so I would argue that had Ebola not happened, you know, that executive might have lost his job.
But what you're saying is, and perhaps this is more about the news media in all its various forms now, has a kind of attention deficit disorder. So sort of jumping from one scandal, one crisis to the next.
And I think that the new playbook is that there is no playbook. And that every case is different. I mean, the reason why a Clinton survives is different than an Anthony Weiner. And so I don't think that embracing decades-old constructs of crisis management is constructive. It doesn't work.
Well, let me pick, and I started with, I was trying to figure out how to start the show today, and I was thinking of Bill Clinton and Anthony Weiner and just how, even though what they did, very different, but how their paths, and of course what Clinton did was back in the 1990s, so that was quite a long time ago, maybe time to rehabilitate himself. But nonetheless, the response to these two men have been so different.
Well, first of all, the Lewinsky scandal was the first internet age scandal. It broke on Drudge, even though it was about to break on Newsweek, and then it ended up being really broken in the legacy media by the Washington Post. And so it was the first great internet scandal. There are a number of differences. You always have to look at your client or the principal about what they've got going for them and against them. You know, Bill Clinton was a guy who people wanted to get away with stuff.
They wanted him to get away with it.
Wanted him. I mean, I believed that then and I believe it now, that when he said, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman," what the American public heard was, "Yeah, you did, but we knew you did, and we knew it 10 years ago, so and we still like you and we still voted for you."
But are you saying that we don't mind being lied to by some people?
Well, Bill Maher said the American public wants to be lied to by the smoothest guy, which is a funny comment, but and not altogether wrong. I think that, you know, but with Clinton, you had a guy people liked. You had a Dow Industrial Average of 10,000 for the first time in history. There was no war. With Anthony Weiner, you have this kind of unattractive personality, a guy who has no charm and who's tweeting pictures of his nether regions. That is a very different thing. And so, I mean, it's one thing getting caught in a sex scandal. It's another thing taking pictures of yourself, and we all know what we mean by yourself, and putting them out on the internet. That is a really difficult thing to try to justify. Whereas with Clinton, a lot of people say he had an affair, but a lot of people do that. With Anthony Weiner, we're wondering what kind of person does this.
So it's really, in many ways, from your perspective, about someone's personality, whether they can, quote unquote, get away with something or not?
Plus the nature of the sin. You know, I mean, is the sin exotic or is it boring? When you have a boring sin, and, you know, in this day and age, affairs, you know, are pretty tame concepts. But a sitting congressman taking the pictures he was taking and putting them out there, you know, that is exotic.
And also getting angry at people when they called him out. I mean, I remember seeing interviews or press conferences that he had, and he seemed a bit unhinged.
Well, he was notorious in Washington for being as smooth as sandpaper, you know, going down a sewer drain. I mean, this is a New Yorker who liked to pick fights. And Bill Clinton has this sort of way of, you know, there is a perverse head-tilting humility about him. When he's a scoundrel, he's sort of going, "Now, we all know I'm a scoundrel." Whereas Anthony Weiner is basically saying, "You don't like me? You have a problem with me? Come here.
Yeah.
I'm going to take you on right on the street." And that's not an attractive personality.
You also write, while we're talking about sexual scandals, you also write about David Vitter, senator from
Louisiana.
Who was seeing prostitutes.
Yep.
And he's still in the Senate.
He's still in the Senate.
And nothing seemed to stick to him.
No, it didn't. And part of it is because of the political backdrop. He's from Louisiana. And you always have to look at who the constituents are. I think that even though he's a Republican and you have that hypocrisy backdrop, Louisiana is like, and they invented scoundrels, and so it's not a big deal there. Now, if you were to have, let's say, George W. Bush get caught in a sex scandal, that pushes buttons for similar reasons why the Cosby situation does. The whole idea of people who someone says to you, "Everything you've heard about this person is now the opposite of what you think you knew." That's a story, even if it's false.
Well, let's talk a bit about Bill Cosby, only because he's been in the news so much. There are now several women that have come forward to say that he essentially sexually assaulted them. His approach seems to be, and he was on Scott Simon's show on NPR, asked some of these questions, absolute total silence. He said nothing. Is that, you know, whether it's true or not, is that a good thing to do from your perspective?
You know, there are – one of the things you see in damage control is there are no solutions. There are only options. And options are usually horrible or less bad. And what you have to look at with a Bill Cosby is this is a 77-year-old man, not at the beginning of his career, worth hundreds of millions of dollars. If he feels like being silent, he can be silent. Whereas, let's say General Motors, if they have a recall, they can't be silent. Now, there's a price tag for that silence.
Right.
If he wants to have a new TV show, people are going to expect more adjudication of this. If he wants to continue performing, that's going to come up. So do I think it was unusual for him? And when we say silent, we're not just talking strategically. We are talking he actually was silent.
He said nothing.
Right. And I found it kind of interesting. But I would not say categorically that that is the wrong thing to do because, look, we don't know what he knows. We don't know whether these allegations are false. We don't know if he's about to discredit them. And the other possibility is if – given that they are 30 years old, there may not be that much new to cover. So that may have been the best of his less bad options.
Well, and it's always difficult. We're talking about something that neither of us know what is true and what isn't true. But let's say it's not true. Does silence help somebody? If someone takes the fifth, I think the feeling is perhaps they did something. If someone is silent – it can be construed that way as well.
Well, the problem, though, is we all look at this on the counterfactual. And what I mean by that is the great fantasy of damage control is if you only did the thing you did not do, that would have been the answer. What I would tell you is the proverbial interview with Oprah where you go and you talk about your situation. In theory, that's a great idea. My experience in my field is that those interviews that everybody says are such great ideas rarely turn out as well in reality. Now, if you're Bill Clinton and you go on 60 Minutes with your wife as a candidate, you have to remember something about Bill Clinton. Talking himself out of situations, that's what he does. That's not just something he does well. It's who he is. When you've got a mega celebrity, and I've had these people and CEOs, you know, what if you go on TV and you're accused of defrauding people of their 401ks to the tune of $50 billion? I had a client once who I parted ways with who insisted on going on 60 Minutes to tell his side of the story, and people didn't want to hear a word he said. Right. They, no matter what he said, they said, you're a no-good liar. And his better option would have been to say nothing.
Well, we're almost up at a break here. I see that Netflix has postponed Bill Cosby's comedy special. Also, Bill Cosby is getting disinvited. So, again, whether it happened or not, that's, I guess, a kind of a pushback.
It's an extremely real consequence. But, you know, you always have to look at what your options are and what your options aren't. And I'm not surprised at all this has happened.
And that's Eric Desenhall, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, founder and CEO of Desenhall Resources. That's a crisis management firm located in Washington, D.C. Also author of a new book called Glass Jaw, a manifesto for defending fragile reputations in an age of instant scandal. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In this digital age, both good news and bad news can travel fast. For individuals and companies, scandal and controversy can go viral in an instant and can live online forever. I'm talking with Eric Desenhall, who has spent about the last three decades managing the reputations of people and corporations, and again, the author of a new book called Glass Jaw. And you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments about what we're talking about? Let me get Dale from Landenberg to join the conversation. Dale, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
Sure.
I just want to bring up a skeptical kind of point. Like, who makes it through these crises and who doesn't? Like, Clinton makes it. Clinton is very friendly to big money, big spying, big war. Look at Howard Dean, who went down on really a contrived audio piece. The day or 2 days after he said, maybe the media needs to be broken up. So is it just about crisis management, or is it who makes it and who's friendly.
Who's friendly to the media?
Who's friendly to the media and big money and the owners of our politicians?
Okay, that's a big question there, Dale. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, I would argue that a lot of crisis management, and I argue this in Glassjaw, a lot of it's useless. And so I think Dale is not wrong to raise the question. I mean, I am calling BS on my own industry. I believe that it is often useless. I believe Clinton survived, number one, because people liked him. Number two, times were good. Number three, people hated his enemies. And one of the first things I look at when I get a case is who are the enemies. And number four, when Clinton said, you know, one of the cliches you hear is that he apologized and survived. No, what really happened is he lied. And then number two, we stonewalled. Number three, he said we have to stop the politics of personal destruction. Number four, he called in his top people and said, I want you to destroy the Republicans in Congress. And number five, when the Republicans were exposed for their own sexual hypocrisy, then he survived. And so it's a complicated thing, but it wasn't all crisis management. I mean, I could never say to a client, my idea for you is to lie. But Bill Clinton, that was his idea to lie, and it worked. It's not moral, but it worked.
But do you think this issue of hypocrisy, that in certain ways, I mean, there's almost nothing more offensive than hypocrisy?
Well, you know, the Americans have a problem with it because it gets back to our class sense that when someone is a hypocrite, what they're really saying is, I think you're so stupid that I could fool you. And so, but with Bill Clinton, we all knew what he was. When John Edwards based his whole campaign on his sort of John Hughes marriage, he's the good-looking guy who goes for the plain girl, and it turns out he's cheating on the plain girl. At the same time, he's saying, taking marital vows. I mean, it was just so catastrophically dishonest that there was no way to survive it. But I also think that the media during the Clinton age were very willing to take a hard look at Republican sexual hypocrisy, which helped Clinton.
Well, and I guess we keep getting stuck on sex here, but I guess that shouldn't be surprising if we're talking about crisis management, because I was also thinking about this Canadian broadcaster, Gian Gomeshi, had a show on the Canadian broadcasting called Q. In fact, we carried it for a bit here on WHYY, hosted by him. He was accused of engaging in non-consensual violent sex, BDSM-type stuff. He did do this long Facebook post, both so saying, you may not like how I live, but this is what I do, and everything that happened to me was consensual. As a crisis manager person, would you advise someone to do that?
Well, you know, my experience has been detail is not your friend. You know, one of the things—
Less is more?
Yeah. I mean, the media love to say, if you just sit down and tell the truth— That, you know, this will be good. And what I always say is to my journalist friends is that's good for you. That's not good for the principal. It's like every cop show where the cop says, okay, Spike, if you just confess to killing these people, that'll be good for everybody. And Spike confesses. But what the show doesn't show you as it goes into the 11 o'clock hour is Spike spends the next 60 years in jail. So I don't find these grand confessionals, they work great in a college PR class, but I tend to hit back harder, and I tend not to be – I see no correlation between the more you disclose, the more you're vindicated. Not at all.
You mentioned the NFL, and I mean, I was reading something yesterday about a couple of the – I guess they're now ex-wives I think ex-wives of some of the players who claim that they were beaten up by their husbands. Told by the NFL, you know, call us first before you call the police. How does and this is all getting played out in a very public arena. It's a sport that millions of people just totally are crazy about.
Well, you know, you have the crisis and then you have the farce surrounding the crisis, which in the book I call the fiasco vortex. Right. I mean, the domestic violence issue is real. I don't believe it's going to be the undoing of the NFL. Because I believe you have a farce surrounding the crisis, okay? You have videotapes showing, you know, Ray Rice. Then you have, if Roger Goodell holds a news conference, the farce declares Roger Goodell must be fired. And so you have this sort of hysteria surrounding the crisis management. But the net-net is the next day after Goodell's news conference, the stands are packed. And so what I have to look at, because I have worked on issues like this, is what do I have on my hands here? My view is that the NFL situation will remain something people talk about, but the domestic violence issue will not lead people to not come to football games. I think that head injuries may eventually lead people not to go to football games, but just because the very same people who wanted to hear about Clinton's sex life wanted him to remain in office, the very same people who talk on ESPN and watch ESPN about the NFL scandal are still going to watch the game.
The other thing I got from reading your book is your advice to these CEOs, let's say, or even corporations, which is don't do bad things. I mean, it's not like don't get in trouble or don't get caught, but don't misbehave.
Well, people think that one of the points of Glassjaw is that there is a misconception that the crisis management is somehow collateral to the crisis. I did it when the BP oil spill happened. I debated somebody on a TV show who said, well, BP isn't using Twitter correctly. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's their problem. They're not tweeting enough. And my point was there will be a direct and immediate correlation between when that well is plugged and when this recedes from the news. It is not. I horrified an audience by the day after the spill saying BP does not have a PR problem. They have an oil spill.
Yes.
And I think what's interesting is when you look at a company like Exxon that knew they lost the PR battle after Valdez and spent 25 years revamping their safety practices, not having a spill is the best thing an oil company can do for PR.
Well, and speaking about BP and you talk about the sort of visuals, I mean, we could all watch just the oil just gushing into the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, what can you say about that?
Yeah, you're going to tweet about it and that's better. Mm-hmm. And look, I mean, my view was that Tony Hayward, even though people love to seize on the fact that he made a statement, I want my life back. Oh, ha, 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 ha. That was bad crisis management. Okay, fine. I would argue that his job was over the minute the spill happened, because mm-hmm. the first thing that happens when there is a catastrophe is the highest ranking person has to go down. And, you know, I absolutely believe that had Joe Paterno died 2 months before the Sandusky revelations, his statue would still be standing, because once that scandal broke, the highest, most powerful person has to go down, whether or not they deserve to or not. There is an immediate assumption of complete conspiratorial guilt. Even when the facts don't support it, somebody big has to go down, even if they shouldn't or should.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Eric Dezenhall, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, founder and CEO of Dezenhall Resources. That's a crisis management firm. And he grew up here in the Delaware Valley, also author of a new book called Glass Jaw, a manifesto for defending fragile reputations in an age of instant scandal. And I got a lot of comments here, and I've also got some phone calls that I want to take. But you mentioned Joe Paterno, Penn State, the Sandusky scandal. We're here in Pennsylvania where this issue is just so both fraught and both so raw, obviously because of the breadth of the scandal as it pertains to Jerry Sandusky. And then all the controversy about Penn State and the
NCAA.
And the NCAA. And even Governor Corbett and even Attorney General Kathleen Kane. I mean, it's all so wrapped up in each other.
Yeah, it's very combustible. And I think what you see happen, I mean, we're certainly not going to on this show debate Sandusky's behavior and his wickedness. What we can debate, however, is the crisis management. And I believe that whenever you have something like this, that there has to be people immediately revert to the assumption that somebody had perfect information and chose to cover it up. What we're beginning to see is it's not that simple. And there is a very big difference between somebody being told, I'm a little concerned about this, and then somebody having perfect information about everything Sandusky did, and after receiving perfect information, doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And what you're beginning to see is, look, somebody like Louis Free is brought in to burn somebody down. I mean, he's brought in to throw a virgin in the volcano and get somebody indicted. And that's what ends up happening. And what's hard about crisis management is now 3 years later, we're beginning to hear some contrary facts that could not have come out or didn't come out immediately after the scandal, because this fiasco vortex that I write about is a life of its own. And the only thing the vortex cares about is somebody burning for this.
Well, I understand everything that you just said, but with the Sandusky scandal, we're talking about children as victims.
That's why it's so emotional.
Well, of course. And how horrifying what he did to those children.
Well, that's right. And the more serious the allegations, the more the emotional reaction is somebody has to suffer for this. I don't care who it is as long as they're powerful. But, you know, when you start to see some of the things that's coming out, Free working with the NCAA to determine what some conclusions might be, this is not a squeaky clean counteroffensive. And one of the things I find in my business is the mythology of the spin doctor is that the spin doctor can come in and immediately turn things. My experience is quite the opposite, is that it often takes years to begin to figure things out. That's why when somebody says, you know, Bill Cosby ought to do this or somebody ought to do that, in the cases I work on, we simply don't know what the facts are in round one, but we do know how they're going to be portrayed, and what's going to be portrayed is guilt to the principal.
Let me get some callers in. We have Jay from Oxford, Pennsylvania, joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Jay. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. I find it disingenuous that what we now term crisis management really is public relations. The crisis is not the reputation besmirching, but that seems to be what we assign the idea of crisis management to now. Using the Ray Rice case as a context that was just discussed, the crisis is not that the NFL's reputation is besmirched. The crisis is that women are being beaten.
Absolutely.
Nothing is being addressed. And I find it very disingenuous that crisis management really tends to not focus on the problem at hand, but focuses on the negative public relations of those involved.
Oh, fair enough, Ajay. Yes,
it's a great point. In fact, Glassjaw opens up with a story about a client of mine who was the crisis manager for one of the biggest chemical companies in the world. And he said to me he knew it was time to retire when they had a chemical spill. And the CEO said, "Get up here, Harry. We have a PR problem." And what his point was, in the old days, a chemical spill meant you cleaned it up and you compensated the community and you put in safeguards so it doesn't happen again. He realized his career as he knew it was over because not only was the CEO thinking that the real problem was a PR problem, but that my guy Harry had the magical skills to heal it. You know, I would say, back to the BP example, BP had an environmental problem and an oil spill and a catastrophe. And the whole idea diagnostically that these are just reputational issues is absolutely correct. Now, that said, my job is to deal with the PR side of it. But part of what I do is I have to go into a company and organization and get a sense what is the remedial behavior going to be. And if I sense that they just want me to do some sort of black magic, well, first of all, I'm going to fail because the PR industry is a very dishonest industry, mostly to its own clients, and that they deceive them into believing they can fix things that they can't fix. But, you know, I think one of the reasons why we had a successful World Series is, lest we forget, the Major League Baseball is still alive in part because they really did deal with the steroids issue.
Well, and we could spend the whole hour talking about football. We've done that in the past. And Jay, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. But do things like boycotts, not that people are going to boycott football. I mean, they're just, it's not going to happen.
Or it's not going to work.
Well, would it work? I mean, if people were to say, I'm just not going to turn my TV on, I'm not going to go down to the stadium, and we're just going to turn our back on this sport.
I think that is something that, you know, I have worked with corporate sponsors that are concerned about things like that. What's been interesting about the NFL scandal is that there has been no real meaningful spillover into people associating corporate sponsors with domestic violence. There's been some noise, but people are separating the fact that the domestic violence issue is real from the fact that anybody other than the individual perpetrators caused it. I don't see the correlation, I mean, between people being concerned about domestic violence and then saying, well, I'm just not going to watch Sunday. Yeah. It's simply not happening.
We have an email from JM. I'm going to just read the boiled down part. If you are a politician in trouble, your chances of survival are better. If you're a Democrat, as in you can keep your insurance company if you like it, and I did not have sex with that lady, Romney's 47% remark. I think he's wondering whether
– there's media bias?
Whether Democrats are more forgiven than Republicans.
It depends. I have a lot of friends who are journalists. They all deny political bias. The fact is, as I say, I've said to them, is I think in the legacy media, I don't think it's 60-40. I think it's 95-5.
95-5.
Absolutely. And now that said, what they often argue is, well, there's Fox News and talk radio, and that's true. But I do believe that I remember as a young guy in Reagan's White House, the level of hatred that the Washington Press Corps had for Reagan personally. But what Reagan was able to do is talk over the heads of the Washington Press Corps. I believe that the legacy media have an enormous investment in Obama, and I don't believe that – it's not that they are conspiring to cover for him. I just don't think they want to hurt him the way I think they really want to hurt George W. Bush. I do believe there is that bias to some degree. That said, is you can't look at the Lewinsky scandal and say that the legacy media did nothing. You can't look at Wiener and say they did nothing. And you can't look at the survival of Vitter and say that Republicans never survive scandals, because they can.
Well, I want to take another short break, get back to our conversation. And again, Eric Dezenhall is our guest in this hour of the show, founder, CEO of Dezenhall Resources, again, a crisis management firm. We are talking about scandal and crisis and controversy. Also author of a book called Glass Jaw. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Eric Dezenhall. He's been in the crisis management business for about 30 years now, and he says we live in an era of instant scandal when anything like a misstep or a poorly worded tweet or even a Facebook admission or a suspicious-looking photo can get magnified. He writes in his new book, Glass Jaw, that sometimes laying low is the best strategy because it's nearly impossible to get ahead of the story these days. Glass Jaw refers to a boxing term about not being able to take a punch. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I want to pick up on something you said, and I'm assuming you're talking about the mainstream media and Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is this whole other media that talks about Obama being a Kenyan or a Muslim.
Well, absolutely, yeah.
And you know, says some pretty horrifying things about him. That stuff also ends up on the mainstream media. So in certain ways, I mean, I think it's a different environment that we're living in, but I don't think you could say that this president hasn't been beaten up.
No, I don't say that he's not been beaten up. I just think that there's some, back to boxing terms, I think that there's punch pulling. I mean, I think nobody disputes Fox News is conservative and the talk radio tends to be conservative. But the fact is a lot of the world still moves on legacy media. But one of the things that we often do in crisis management is we watchdog the legacy media with other media. But, you know, to me, I don't know many people who really believe Obama is a Muslim, but it's such a powerful narrative that it's easy to introduce. I mean, now what's changed is that now that everybody has a modem and has access, is you can be a reporter. And if I want to get somebody in trouble, there are tricks you can use that didn't used to be available. If I wanted to get Marty Moscoe in trouble, I put on an anonymous blog that her office has been raided by the FBI. I then call the Philadelphia Inquirer and tell them. The Philadelphia Inquirer begins to call the FBI and says, has Marty's office been raided by the FBI?
You just got me in trouble, just so you know, but go ahead.
Well, we all know how sinister you are. Then someone calls the FBI and the FBI says, we don't comment on investigations. Ah, Marty's in trouble. So there's that type of mischief. Mm-hmm. that really can be made, that, you know, there are no referees anymore.
Let me see what Jonathan from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Jonathan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to go back for a minute to the Jerry Sandusky scandal. And
sure.
I was surprised and, of course, very pleased at the level of widespread vocal outrage, which is appropriate. The reason I was surprised is because I haven't seen that with the same type of scandal with the Catholic Church. And so from a crisis management standpoint, I'm wondering, are there any situations or entities which essentially the top that needs to go down is off limits?
Well, that's interesting, Jonathan, because I would say, having done a number of shows about the scandal in the Catholic Church, that many Catholics have left the church. They are not going to church. And that's part of their protest about what the Catholic Church both did and covered up.
Yeah, I guess I still don't see the same accountability or the church being held responsible, I guess, in the same type of universal way.
Well, the circumstances are different, but I think with the Sandusky scandal, you have one guy, okay, who easily symbolizes, and rightly, I think, symbolized the problem. But I also think you had parties involved with the mix that were not the Pope, but there is a certain frivolity associated with sports. And so people feel less guilty about going after someone over sports than they do taking on an entire church, which, you know, a lot of people understandably take seriously. So you had players in the Sandusky scandal who could be taken down with greater ease than an entire church hierarchy. And people don't really feel guilty about taking down a university president or a football coach because, hey, you know what? Even if we were wrong about them, so what? It's just football. Hmm. You know, the fact is you know, having spent my career working with people in scandal and seeing a continuum of good and evil, you know, you're dealing with human beings who some who may have been rightly destroyed, but plenty who have been wrongly destroyed and destroyed at a greater magnitude than their actual sin may have been. And I think that that's a different variable.
Jonathan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Interestingly, we've talked about these various scandals, allegations, admissions. We haven't really talked about women, and I don't know whether women get in less trouble than men or whether they're treated differently compared to men.
There's a huge look, I'm coming at this from the perspective as a clinician, not as a political activist, and I would tell you there is a massive double standard. When guys get into trouble, they're dudes being dudes. When women get into trouble, it's almost there is this subtext that they are unstable and they must be stopped. I mean, Martha Stewart got into trouble over a $40,000 trade at the same time Enron and WorldCom were making hundreds of billions of dollars disappeared. And you know, you would have thought Martha Stewart had committed an act of evil that was, you know, beyond the pale. Well, the fact is she's attractive. She's a celebrity. She's a woman. She's a billionaire. The idea that people really understood the idea that she got a tip from a friend in the Hamptons and did something.
At some cocktail party somewhere, right?
Right. And that was easier to fathom than Enron, which nobody understands. But I do think that having worked with both men and women, there almost is, including, by the way, from other women. I don't see any evidence that women are nicer to other women in these situations, but there is a desire to hyper-punish women who get into these problems.
What about someone like Paula Deen?
Well, you know, race is the cyanide pill of scandal. You simply don't survive racial scandals. The survival rate is terrible. And when you have a woman of a certain generation who, even though her admission, she admitted she used the word 30 years ago when she had a gun to her head in a bank robbery, the fact is when you have someone like this who is selling kind of foods that are not exactly the pop culture's, the media culture's favorite type of fatty foods, there are a number of reasons to want her to burn down. And I think, you know—
Are you saying the media did it or she did it to herself?
I am saying that not only did she admit to using the epithet in a deposition, but there was a great desire to pile on and see someone of her demographic suffer.
You're saying the media is a snob?
I think that a lot of the media don't like a Southern woman in her 60s who used racial epithets no matter when she used them. And I think it was too much of a fun – I don't think that it's political so much. It's a great story. You know, it's a great story that this you know, this household name used verbiage like this years ago.
If she had been a client, I don't know if she was or not.
She was not, or I couldn't talk about it. But
I mean, what did she do something wrong in terms of how she defended or explained herself?
Well, you know, part of what I talk about in the book is the fiasco vortex, where no matter what you do, it's considered mishandled. Every interview she did was considered mishandled. Some weren't great, but let me tell you something. When you're in crisis, not everybody is Bill Clinton. Not everybody is a professional crisis manager. When you get hit by a bus, you're not at your smoothest. And I think she is probably served well by laying low and coming back in a much smaller targeted forum. And I think that when you have scandalized people, often what their best option is to go away and come back in a smaller forum.
We have an email from Jackie, actually something I wanted to ask. Jackie asked, does the show Scandal portray a true look at how PR problems are handled in Washington? I was also thinking of that show Ray Donovan. Isn't he a PR scandal?
I have a whole section in my book about how crisis managers, who, by the way, years ago, nobody cared about us. Now we've become these magical figures in popular culture. I will tell the caller or the emailer, I cannot do anything that Olivia Pope can do. It is sheer fantasy. It's great fantasy. And my students, I teach at Georgetown, one of them asked me, what's the difference between me and Kerry Washington? And I said, I'm just a lot better looking, because that's all I could come up with.
Now you really are a liar, but no, go ahead.
Hey, easy. But the fact is that what people, including clients, believe we can do, and I'm very hard on the PR industry, because the PR industry wants us to believe if you hire us, we have a way to use social media that can make – we can erase the internet. It is a lie. It's great entertainment. But part of the problem is because we watch shows like Scandal, we expect the scandalized to be able to extricate themselves from situations like this, and it is simply rarely doable.
We have a comment from Jose. Does the federal government hire outside crisis consultants such as yourself to manage some of their crises?
I don't take on government clients, but I think that I imagine that the government does use contractors like this, but they also have their own internal people who manage controversies in their communications arenas, but they don't contract to me.
Let me get Jack to join us. Jack from Wilmington, Delaware. Hi, Jack. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Obviously, you're a crisis management person, but I wonder if you have any experience or thoughts on the flip side. How do you create a positive buzz and a positive message for a fundraiser, a cause, or something? I'd laugh that you could almost make a darn wardrobe out of ribbons and rubber bands and stuff that are floating out there. How do you break through that and create a viral, you know, message that people latch onto and support your cause?
Well, everybody wants Everybody wants things to go viral. I mean, you know, in every ad agency across the country right now, there's a meeting where the client comes in that says, here's what I want, and I want it to go viral. Oh, okay. You know, that's like me saying, I wish I had started Apple Computer. I mean, look, the fact is some things catch on and some things don't. I think one of the issues that often comes up in crisis management is the issue of social media. And what I would tell you, even though it's not a direct answer to your question, is social media is a dispersive technology. It's very good at getting stuff out there. Crisis management is a containment discipline. It's the opposite. And I think that, you know, social media is like taking a feather pillow and slicing it and throwing the feathers all over on the top of a building on a windy day. My job is to collect the feathers. And it's a lot harder. And whenever I hear big ad agencies and communications firms talk about social media as a crisis management vehicle, that's some real dangerous talk. Because the fact is, in only one out of every 25 cases, is social media a viable crisis management issue, because so much of what I'm trying to do is calm things down. So I think, look, if you're trying to promote the new iPhone or you're promoting a walk for breast cancer, I think social media is great. If you're trying to get people to stop believing hearing things about Bill Cosby, it's a disaster.
You mentioned Apple. We were talking about this before we went on the air, and I was saying to you that it seems like Apple writes its own rules. I mean,
they do.
You know, and they can, in a sense, do almost anything. I mean, the scandal was the treatment of the factory workers in Southeast Asia that didn't seem to stick to Apple.
The rules are different. I mean, just like, you know, when the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal broke, I wrote an article that never appeared called Why Al Gore Will Pay. And the basic thesis was Al Gore is the guy who doesn't get the girl and he's going to go down for this. Apple violates every basic rule of crisis management. You're not supposed to be secretive. They're secretive. You're never supposed to insult you're supposed to be empowering. Steve Jobs insulted his employees. When they had the antenna problem a few years ago, somebody at the company basically said, well, you're probably too stupid to hold your phone.
Wasn't that Steve Jobs who said that?
I think he said something like
something like that.
And the fact is because we love our iPhones, you're allowed to do things. The first thing you learn in crisis management is that the rules are different from different companies. I had the CEO of an oil company once say to me, why can't you do for me what he knew I did for a cosmetics company? I said, you're an oil company. Nobody likes you. They never will.
Let me ask you about Tesla. And I remember a year or so ago, Tesla got a really bad write-up in the New York Times about it. It didn't have the kind of mileage that it was. It was promising that it did. Tesla sort of did an interesting response to that.
Yeah, Tesla basically investigated the investigator. And they went scorched earth, burning down the New York Times story. And they really ended up profiting from it. And what I would argue is I not only think it was the right tactic, because I do, you also have to remember they make a product people want to succeed. And what I would say is if General Motors came to me and said, hey, can we go and burn down this New York Times reporter who did this story? It would be a real problem for General Motors. So I think that Tesla has the backdrop of this scrappy startup. You know, they're making a product people are really, really excited about. So they can do things others can't. But the whole idea of savage pushback was a great idea on their part and totally within the context of what they make, but not everybody could get away with it.
So is reputation, I mean, sort of bottom line, is that the currency of today?
You know, it is, but I believe there's a lot less you can do about your reputation than people in my business would have you believe. I think a lot of it comes down to, I mean, when you look at Toyota's recovery, they didn't recover because of goodwill. They recovered because people liked their Toyotas, and their strategy was preaching to the choir. And so this whole conceit that if you have goodwill, you could borrow against it is not true. I mean, with Bill Cosby, we're seeing the fact that he is beloved has hurt him, because people want to believe more that he is the opposite of Cliff Huxtable. I think that a lot of those who recover are those who recover because they have good products, or Bill Clinton is a good politician. You recover in the context of your competence, not because people love your reputation.
On that note, we have to end our conversation. Eric Desenhall, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And he's the author of Glass Jaw, a manifesto for defending fragile reputations in an age of instant scandal, founder and CEO of Desenhall Resources, and grew up here in the Philadelphia area. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including check us out on Facebook. You can see a picture of our guest. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.